everybody. I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. Bear with me if you will. I'm a little under the weather, but I'm really grateful to be here. My sobriety date is November 18th of 2007, and this is my home group. And, you know, basically I'm just going to jump to announcing who's speaking for me. I asked Danny if he would speak for me. I don't know. He's a friend of mine. I probably haven't even known him a year, but, you know, I watch people in these rooms. It's one thing to talk the talk, but it's another thing to walk the walk. And, you know, Danny's young, and he's been sober for 25 years. So, I really admire that. And I watch Danny show up, and, you know, he works in an environment that can be a little draining of your soul at times, a little chaotic. And, you know, he goes to a meeting afterwards, and that's why he's been sober for 25 years. So, here's Danny.
I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. First, when Jen said that he was young, I thought she was talking about somebody else because you know, the first thing I want to say is I'm very impressed with this group. Just to see a bunch of young people in recovery who run such a tight ship, you know, you guys really take pride in what you do here, and you also know how to have fun. You guys have, you do parties, you do all kinds of activities, and that's the balance that I believe, that's the balance in recovery, is to take care of business, and because this is serious business, this is life and death, we're dealing with a stone killer, and to be able to have fun when it's time. And you guys know how to do that, and I'm very impressed. And that's a huge message to send out to people who are struggling, who are coming in and thinking their life is over because I can't drink anymore, so I'm doomed to an existence of misery. Well, that's what I thought anyway. Somebody tell me how much time I got. Okay. I'll just knock things over and stare until I'm told to shut up. So anyway, I was born and raised in the Bronx, New York, and I went to Catholic school and I came from an Irish Catholic family. So that's already like the trifecta, you know. That's a recipe for disaster. And my father was an alcoholic, and most of my family were alcoholics, and what I saw was work hard, get paid, spend it all on the weekend, drink, and then do it all over again on Monday. So I didn't come from this family that talked about goals and focus and education and things like that. It was all about just living for the party. So every weekend there was just tons of people in my house playing cards and drinking and having a good time and being stupid and so my neighborhood was just a working class blue collar neighborhood, and the kids we all ran the streets. That's what we did. We just ran the streets from morning till night. When we weren't in school, you get up, you go out, you come back for something to eat, you go back out, you come back for something to eat, you go back out, and then when the street lights come on, you get home. And our parents didn't worry about us. They weren't concerned about where we were because the neighborhood pretty much all looked out for each other, and so we were safe. And in Catholic school, I was taught by Dominican nuns, so their English wasn't that good to begin with. And then when you start acting out you really don't want to be there in the first place. I was bouncing off the walls, and I wasn't a really good kid or student. So I got smacked around a lot. You know, the nuns would really, they could fight, and they could really fight. But you didn't go home and tell, because when you went home and if you told, then you got beat again. So the mentality was, you know, respect old people, respect cops, respect nuns and priests and all that, and everybody else was fair game. So, but I can tell you, you know, one thing I recall really, really well is that from probably around the age of 5, I was afraid. And I don't know what that was about, but it was just this fear. You know, we talk about ungrounded, unfounded fear. And that's what I had. And I was 5. I was afraid of everything. Afraid to play, afraid not to play, afraid to go out, afraid not to go out, afraid to go to school, afraid not to go to school. I was just afraid a lot. Most of the kids I went to school with got worse beatings than I did because the principal, she went to grade school with my mother. So while all the other kids got worse beatings, I got sent to her office and I would just cry and she'd say, "Do you want me to tell your mother?" And I would cry and she'd say, "No, go and say six Hail Marys and, you know, something." I had to go to church every morning. It was horrendous. So I was raised with this fear, be afraid of God because you will be punished. If you touch something you shouldn't touch, you will be punished. If you look at it, you'll be punished. If you think about it, you'll be punished. If you think about thinking about it, you'll be punished. So it was too much pressure. So I figured, well, you know, I'm going to hell, and I might as well go down in flames. So I got through grade school, and I ended up going to public high school, and that was the beginning of the end. So I had total freedom. Nobody cared what you did if you showed up. Nothing. Nobody even knew who you were. So that summer between grade school and high school was when I started drinking. And, you know, I got picked on a lot as a kid, and so I was always afraid. You know, I was just always afraid. And one thing I was good at was making fun of people. So I became very fast. Because I would risk a beating for the laugh, and I would make fun of people, and then I would just run because I knew I was going to get chased. So, but if they got their hands on me, I caught a beating. But I would, and I'd know it was coming because I could hear the words coming out of my mouth, and I'd go, "Don't do it." But I knew it would make people laugh, and so I would risk the beating. So I caught quite a few, but I got faster and faster, so I was able to avoid a lot. And so now I started drinking, and I'm going to tell you something about the first drink. All the fear I had all my life, all the inadequacy that I had, all the worries that I had, all the insecurities that I had, they vanished immediately vanished. And I can remember thinking, you know what? I don't know what this stuff is, but if it can do that for me that fast, I will never, ever let go of it. So a relationship formed immediately. And now I not only was removed of all that stuff, but I was at least 5'9". I had muscles, I was brave, I was strong, I was tough, I could talk to anybody. I wasn't afraid of girls. It was like, wow, man, this is just a miracle. I've been searching for this my whole life, and here it is, in a bottle. So I spent that summer looking for a lot of the kids that picked on me through grade school, and I would beat them up. So I started to develop a reputation. And I like that. I like that reputation that I was unpredictable. Went to public high school and I spent 2 years there. The first year I was in the classroom but whacked out. The second year I was outside whacked out. I used to pay for blank report cards and have somebody fill them out, and my parents caught on 2 years later. They pulled me out, put me in a private school where there were like 8 kids in the class. So you really couldn't get away with a whole lot. But I hated it, you know. See, once again, I go, I don't fit in here either, because all I have, here I am 15, I have a black leather jacket and a bad attitude, and I'm already a drunk. And I'm with these kids, these rich kids, and they're driving Cadillacs at 16. Now I'm just partying with a better group of people, you know. I'm hanging out in these big houses. I'm like, "Where are your parents?" And they're like, "Well, they're in Japan for the next 6 weeks." I'm like, "Cool." So it was 2 more years of that, and I had 4 years of high school with nothing to show for it but a rotten attitude. And I was ashamed of myself. So now I'm starting to feel ashamed. I went and got my equivalency diploma, and I was there with people that had taken it like 5, 6, 7 times, and I said to myself, this is it, man, one shot. If I don't pass it, I'm never coming back. So fortunately, I did. And so my mentality was the same as that I grew up with, just work, spend your money, party, all that, you know, and just let life happen, you know. So that's what I did. And my life was just bumping along, you know, from job to job, from girlfriend to girlfriend, from incident to incident. See, the first 5 years of my drinking, I had a lot of fun. From like 12 to 17, I had a lot of fun. And then the next 3 years, I had some fun because things started to change and things started happening that I really didn't, I would have preferred did not happen. And then the last 2 years, I had absolutely no fun. But you see, when I took that first drink and it said to me, man, I love you more than any human being on the face of this earth, and I will protect you and I will help you and I will take care of you. Don't ever leave me. And I said, I won't. What it didn't tell me then was, in about 8 or 9 years, I'm going to look to destroy you. And I'm going to cause you pain. And I'm going to take things from you. And I'm going to take your soul. And I'm going to humiliate you. And I'm going to embarrass you. It didn't tell me that. But it was already too late by that point. Because I was hooked. And I couldn't get out. So I ended up getting a job with New York City, and I drank myself out of that job. My life really, really got bad. I used to detox at home in bed a lot, and so I'd be in bed shivering and shaking and sweating for 4 or 5 days. And then during one of those episodes, my dog told me that I was pathetic, And I was very impressed because I didn't know that a dog could use a big word like pathetic. I was like, wow. You know? I'm like, that's my dog, you know? And then the very next thought was, you know what? Dogs don't talk. And I knew what I was going through. I was going through the DTs because my father had gone through the same thing when I was 15. Now here I was like 22. So I ended up going to detox. I come out 11 months later, I'm back in detox again. And I don't get it. I don't get it. But in the course of that 11 months, there was something new that popped into my life, and that was the thought of suicide. I did not want to be alive, and I used to curse whatever entity there was out there that I would come to, because I would go, take me, please, if you exist, take me. And the pain, the emotional pain that I lived in, that I existed in, was worse than anything I could ever possibly imagine. It was horrendous. So I ended up going into treatment. And a lot of us know how wonderful that experience can be. So I went to this place and I went, you know what? This is not, I made a bad mistake. I made a bad decision coming to this place. Maybe I'm not that bad. So I went to treatment, and the very first day, it was 30 of us in the day room, and the director was this humongous man. And I'm waiting for words of wisdom. Give me something. You got to give me something because I'm dying here. And he comes out and he looks around and he says, you know what? Only one of you is going to make it. The rest of you are going to die. And he walks away. And I went, well, I guess that's my the sign from above, right? So I go up to the desk and I go, well, where do I sign? And she says, sign for what? I said, to get out, because I ain't going to make it. I'm one of those that's going to die. She said, look, it's the middle of January. Look out the window. It's icy and snowy out there. You got nowhere to go anyway. You lost your last place to live. You don't even have money to put gas in the car to keep the heater going. So why don't you stick around, see what happens? You know, you get a couple of meals, you get a warm place to sleep, see what happens. I said, okay. She's making sense. 2 weeks into it, I hadn't said a word. And they said to me, you, we're watching you, because you haven't said a word. And if you don't start talking, we're not letting you out. And I didn't know they couldn't do that, so. But I believed them. And I said, well, you don't want to hear it. And they said, well, tell us. Because I was listening to people for 2 weeks talking about, I got tools in my toolbox, and I got a sponsor, and I got AA, and I'm going to meetings, and I got a big book, and I got this, and I'm going, oh my God, I don't feel like that. I'm not going to make it. So they said, I said, well, you don't want to hear it. And they said, no, well, just give it a shot. And I said, well, I don't know what the rules are because you might kick me out. And they said, just tell us what's inside of you. Just tell us whatever it is. And I said, I just want to get drunk and blow my brains out. And they said, finally somebody's telling the truth. And I didn't get it. And I said, what about him? He's got tools in the toolbox, and he's got the sponsor and the book. And she said, they're all full of shit. And I didn't get it. But that was the beginning. Because what I learned at that moment was that if I spoke my truth, that I stood a shot. So that passed. And I then moved on to bigger and better things. Like, I just want the pain to go away, because it was just killing me, and I didn't know how to get out of that hurt. The only thing I knew was alcohol, and alcohol just kept me in the hurt even more. So they say, keep talking, and I did. And you know, AA is a lot like the mafia, because if the mafia existed, because like the people that took care of me were Scully and Squid and Preach and Joey D, Nine Finger Ray, Frankie Red, and Angry Everybody. So I started going to meetings, and I was trying to get kicked out of AA because I wanted to drink really bad, and so I was really, my behavior was not good. I was very obnoxious. I was nasty. I was rude to people, and I was disruptive in meetings. And so it was very common for a couple of guys to hook me under my arms and escort me out to the kitchen and have a talk with me. And these were guys that understood, because it was all fear. That's what it was. It was just fear. I was looking to get into a fight so that I could say, A, it doesn't work. See, I'm going to get drunk, lay under a train, and that's the end of it. So, but they understood me, and they helped me, and they talked to me, and they listened to me, and they let me rant and carry on. And they used to take me to these divey diners and make me sit in a corner and surround me where I couldn't get out, and they would just talk and talk and talk. And these guys were like 40 and over, and to me they were half dead. Because I was 23 years old, and I'm like, I would sit there and go, your wives hate you, your dogs hate you, your kids hate you, you losers, you got no life. And they would go, just shut up, because you don't know nothing. You can't talk about recovery because you're dying, and we can help you. So little by little, I started to listen. One night, my mother comes running down to the basement. Oh my God, what did you do? And I said, what? I don't know. She said, there's two callers of guys outside. So I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not in recovery that long. So I'm like, oh shit. Excuse me. So I go to the window, and I look out the window, and it's two carloads of guys from AA. And I go, oh, it's those AA guys. So I go outside, and I go, what do you want? And they go, get in the car. So I said, well, where are we going? Shut up. You ain't paying for gas. Don't worry about it. These guys would hijack me a lot. I'm going to tell you something. They took really good care of me. They protected me. They saved me from myself. They tolerated me. I was intolerable. My behavior was just really horrendous. I'm embarrassed. But they put up with me, you know. They put up with my nonsense. And they just kept drilling it into me, and they would listen to me. And I would burst into tears, and they would listen to me. And I would make fun of them, and they would listen to me. And they just put up with me. And I started going through my steps, you know, and I just gave everybody a hard time. And when I came to the third step, my sponsor took me to his sponsor's house because I wore him out. And it turned out that his sponsor was that big guy who ran the treatment center. they helped me through all that stuff. They helped me through my fourth step, my fifth step, all my steps. They helped me to change. They helped me to become a human being. See, I was raised in recovery. I was raised in AA because I was a baby when I got here. I was just a snot-nosed brat baby, and I acted like one. And they raised me. Men in recovery taught me how to be a man. My sponsor told me how to tie a necktie. I mean, these guys loved me. They taught me. They just taught me life skills. They taught me how to resist in society, how to go to a job and be responsible, and how to talk to women, how to date. They taught me all these life skills in addition to the steps and everything else. And 2.5 years into recovery, I was at a meeting, and the director of that treatment center came up to me and he said, you know, from that day until this day, you were the one. And he said a couple guys died. A couple of them never came back. Some of them have been in and out, but you were the one from that day to this day. I was amazed. I'm like, me? Like, I'm not worthy, you know? Through the years, I've made a lot of mistakes. And I'm going to tell you something. I've made a lot of mistakes, and I drove sponsors crazy to the point where they would just cut me off and say, call me before you drink. And I usually knew when they said that I was in trouble. But I sometimes made those decisions anyway. And I can remember one night in particular calling my sponsor at 3 o'clock in the morning from a bar. I was whacked out drinking soda. So I was caffeined out of my mind, and I was trying to find a relationship. So, because I didn't know where else to go. And it wasn't happening. So, I'm crying on the phone in a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he says, I'll leave the front door unlocked, sleep on the couch, I'll talk to you in the morning. Morning came, he said, now you ready to listen? And that's how I learned a lot of lessons. What I didn't realize was that I put my neck in a noose over and over and over again. I risked my recovery and my life by not following directions, by not listening. That's really important because I see it happening all the time. When we talk about stuff like, you know, that no relationship stuff in the beginning, when we talk about all the things that we talk about what's important in the beginning, the foundation of recovery, that's no joke. That's no joke because you risk a relapse, you risk your lives, and there's no guarantee people are coming back because relapse happens a lot, and it's not a requirement, and there's no guarantee you're going to make it back. I had probably 5 years in recovery. I got involved in a relationship, and I sort of drifted away from AA and got close to taking my own life because I was not sober. I was abstinent, and I got scared, and I came back, and I did what I had to do, and I had a sponsor, and he said to me, you need to call me every day. You need to be in a meeting every night. You don't want to do it. Go find somebody else. And I was offended. And he said, you're an idiot. And he was right. But I did what I had to do, and my life has progressively gotten so much better. That was a really valuable lesson that I learned. As time's gone on, my spiritual connection has gotten so strong. It's hard to put it into words. It's just, you know, I got a dose of it in the beginning. I got a taste of it, and as I went along, it just got stronger and stronger and stronger. And when I allow my higher power to do his job, see, because this is what he does. He goes, oh, you want it? Okay, here you go. Knock yourself out. I'll just wait. And then when I get worn out, I'll go, all right, I get it. Please, will you please do me a favor and take it back? Because only one of us can have it. We can't both have it at the same time. And so that's been a valuable lesson. Doing what has worked for me in recovery has not been painless. Doing the right thing is not painless. But it's valuable. And the learning that comes from it is tremendous. I just can't believe that I'm in recovery this long. I just can't believe it, you know. I should have been dead. And I'm not. And, you know, I ended up going back to college. I was never going to school. I failed high school algebra 3 times. I was never going back to school. I ended up getting an undergrad degree. I got a master's degree. And I'm like, I look at the name on the diploma and I go, that, I can't believe my name is on that. It's like, do they know that that's my name on there? And then they send me the student loan payment, and then so I know that they know. But that's not who I am. That's not who I am. That's what I did. That's just what I did to be able to do what I do today. And who I am and what I am is I'm an alcoholic. And those words never gave me comfort, because in the beginning it was like, I didn't want to say it. That's why it says we admitted in the first step. It doesn't say we accepted, because acceptance comes later. I never fit in my whole life until I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of time, and it is a perfect fit for me, because all I ever wanted my whole life was to be loved and understood, and I didn't get it until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I got it, and that's where I continue to get it. I moved to South Tampa 6 months ago, and you know, of course, I didn't have a whole bunch of friends right away, and you know, there's a problem here, there's a problem there. I'm moving back. I'm going back to get it. This is not working for me. Should never come here. I had some good people around me that said, "You gotta let go again. You gotta let go. It's a series of letting go. That's what this stuff is about." And so I said, "Okay, I guess I gotta let go again, because God said only one of us can have it." And I let go again, and it's like, it's a breeze. It's a breeze. I'm like, people actually want me around them. And that still blows my mind. I'm like, wow, people actually go, "Hey, you hanging out with us? You coming out? You doing it?" I'm like, wow. It's just, I'm blessed with the ability to remember what it was like for me. And I can recall it like it was yesterday, even though it feels like it was a lifetime ago, because it sort of is. My father died at 68 from complications related to this disease. And he knew I was an alcoholic, and he knew I needed help, but he didn't think he did. So I'm the lucky one, you know. Wow, I am the lucky one. And I just want to thank you guys for letting me do this.